Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to How Music Evokes Emotion. E-inclusion initiatives at the Royal Meteorological Society. How a warming Arctic impacts weather patterns. The need for science communication, amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great. Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Coffee and Geography podcast. And it's a double bill. Taking Aisha's episode last time, I have another colleague with me from the Royal Meteorological Society's Youth and Early Careers group. Regan Mudhar, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, and folks, you didn't hear it in the edit. That was my second attempt. I had a really bad start, so just for transparency. But I got it right the second time. Yeah, because Regan's got a bit of a giggle, and that's great. Because I like to give a laugh sometimes. Yeah, so it's Thursday morning for both of us here while recording. So end of the week, hump day is over. Cheers to that with our water. Yeah. So I'm going to introduce Regan, everybody. So after doing a Master's in Science in Physics with Astrophysics in Bristol, Regan worked in finance for a couple of years, but they returned to academia in 2021, looking at the so-called stratospheric pathway and its far-flung influences on mid-latitude climate and weather extremes for their PhD. Oh, yes, we're so going to talk about that. When Regan is not sitting behind a laptop, you can find them sharing science with the public around Exeter and beyond, including supporting the RMETSOC, as I just mentioned, as their Science Engagement Fellow for Youth and Early Careers since June 2023. And that's how we met.
Yes. Yeah, a bit of a mouthful, that job title, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's what a career. Wow, we'll definitely talk about your career pathway. That is so interesting. So Master's in Astrophysics, which is the degree I originally wanted to do before I did environmental science. I was so interested in that. So yeah, astrophysics to finance to your PhD, to meteorological climatological based PhD. Yeah, which, what a pathway.
Yeah, a bit of a winding road, really.
Yeah, we'll come back to that a bit in a minute. But as I say, we've started with our brews. Neither of us have actually got any caffeine today. I mean, I just feel like I just needed the water. I mean, same for you?
I'm drinking lemon and ginger tea as well.
Oh, lemon and ginger tea. Okay. So you've gone for a little bit more of a flavour for me. I don't know why, but I don't know what it is, folks. People might identify with this, but just those summer days, I don't know whether it's thirst or something like that, but you're just like, all you just really want is water, and it actually does. You're like, oh, that tastes so good. So it's a good thing our bodies are engineered to like water, isn't it? I've had such an ADHD intro to this podcast, everybody. I'm so sorry. Right, so let's start with where you're based then, Ring. So you mentioned Exeter, so that's down there towards the southwest part of the UK. What brought you to Exeter? I mean, is it a place that you've returned to after starting there? I mean, you said you went to Bristol, which is not massively far away, but yeah, I mean, what's been your kind of like your locational history, shall we say?
Yeah, so Bristol for my undergrad, which I loved. I love being a little bit into the southwest, and then I moved back to London for work. But actually, the reason I came to Exeter was, I would say, for the PhD rather than for the place itself. It's just nice that Exeter turned out to be a lovely city.
Yeah, and Exeter is well known in the science communication, particularly because you've got the meteorological, the Met Office there.
Yes.
So have you ever paid a visit?
I have been to the car park twice.
Oh, with the work that you're doing, if you haven't, don't step foot in that building, I'll be very, very surprised.
Hopefully,
come on, Met Office colleagues.
Well, July, a bit of a name drop, the Royal Meteorological Society Youth and Early Career Conference will be at the Met Office. So that is
That's right. Yeah, we'll move on to that in just a second. So the question I always like to ask people, Regan, is about how the locations they've been to forms their identity. So you've mentioned London, obviously Bristol and Exeter. So the Regan, the person that they are today, what would you can you pin down anything about your identity? Like, well, you know, down in Exeter, you know, I still think I've brought this part of London with me. Or when I was doing my university degree in Bristol, I feel like a bit of Bristol culture's with me. Is there any part of your identity today where you feel like has been informed by the places that you've lived?
I actually think, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I actually think that the whole reason I'm here today is because of being in Bristol. So I actually went to Bristol University because I love music and the music scene in Bristol is amazing. Don't tell my mum I said this. So I chose to go to Bristol for that reason. And I did this physics with astrophysics degree, which is amazing. And the people that I ended up getting to know or working with even for my master's, it's because I met them that I ended up doing a PhD, to be honest with you. So my co-supervisor in my master's, he got in contact with me when I was working in London. And he said, oh, I'm moving to Exeter and I'm supervising some PhDs. Do you want to apply? And I did apply because I missed science. You know, I was working in something that had pretty much nothing to do with science.
yeah.
And I kind of figured if I applied for a PhD and I didn't get it, I would still have a job. So I felt like I was an incredibly fortunate position where I really had nothing to lose by just going for it. And it worked out. So I'm here today.
Yeah. Wow. That's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I guess a lot of people who do PhDs kind of like, unless they go straight into a PhD, I guess for academia, so they do their undergrad, they do their masters, they do, you know, and then they go into a PhD, that conveyor belt. And if that's what they want to do, great. I think, so for me, I almost did a PhD in the University of East Anglia because they were going to be researching about seal migration patterns in Antarctica. And actually it was someone at the university who said, Kit, you know, you should put your name in for this. I'm like, well, I don't have a master's. And I've been like a high school teacher for the last 10 years. And like, well, how? I said, yes, but remember you as an undergraduate and the stuff that you do at high school with Antarctica, you know. And actually I was shortlisted, which was amazing. But when you've got someone with research experience in that area, you know, apply as well. But it's fine. It's fine. I'm on the path I am now. But yeah, I mean, I tell you what, I never usually do spill the beans this time, this early in the podcast. Usually do it towards the end of the chat. But because you've mentioned it, I'm definitely going to bring it up now. And I wouldn't worry. Your mum's not listening, and it's, you know, so it's all good. You know, hi mum. So you say that you absolutely adore making it. You're like making it. You say you make it badly, but you make it. You listen to it. You see it live. You collect CDs. You collect set lists. You try to go as many gigs as your bank account will allow. And this is what I love about it. It says, you know, music still makes me feel very much like I have a passion for the world and that humanity. That's such a lovely thing to say. Okay, right. I'll give you free platform here, Regan, to geek out on this. So, okay, you can start with the best gig you ever went to, or what was that first bit of musical composition you heard that was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I don't know.
Oh, well, I like to say my first ever concert, not classical, but like a gig, was Girls Aloud.
Wow.
Very formative for me. I think the best gig I ever went to, it's actually very hard, but my favourite band of all time are Biffy Clyro. And must have been 2010, I saw them play in Wembley Arena. And it was actually the night they were filming their concert, and they released it on DVD the year after. So I have that DVD and I can rewatch it and be like, oh, I was there. So I think that's maybe that's my favorite. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So because that was filmed, that's obviously going to, so I'll definitely put that in the show notes. So Biffy Clyro at Wembley Arena. Yeah. Oh, Wembley Arena. I've been to Wembley Arena a few times. So I've seen, I see. It's a really good venue, actually. I really like it. It's it's big, but it's also, it feels quite intimate. So I've seen Linkin Park there, Third Eye Blind. Who else did I see? I think Incubus as well. So that was when I was in university. I was going through that kind of rock phase. Yeah, but Third Eye Blind are one of my favorite all-time bands. So, and I'm still trying to get like a high-profile kind of like band member on this podcast and talk about how they build world for music. Wouldn't it great? I don't know if I got any members from any of your favorite bands come in, but perhaps you can be a co-host. Let's see if we can if we make that happen. I
know. Yes, let me know.
We can fan them a bit. So okay, so you say you can like collect set lists and stuff like that. So Oh, do you have one at all? Do you have like have one framed anywhere or something?
Well, ooh, obviously the people listening can't see, but I've got a couple behind me.
Yes.
I also have some tour posters which are signed. The one above me.
Right,
so there's one band who I saw when I was about 17, and it was the tour for their first, like their debut album. And I've seen them over the last 10 years or so. And so last time so the poster I have behind me, when I met them that time, they said, oh, I think they've written something like, it's so good to see you again. You've been here from the start. And honestly, to me, that's what live music and following bands is all about.
Wow, that is amazing. Oh my goodness. I never really thought of that from the stage point of view. I mean, when I've done kind of like stuff, lectures and stuff, you know, I mean, sometimes you can actually, in a crowd of people, you can catch people that are familiar. And I wonder, you know, and some people have a better skill for that than others, you know, but if they scan their eyes around, they say, that's a face we've seen before a few times. Wow, what's so special? And what a lovely way of being connecting with the fans and making you appreciate you as a fan.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you feel magical, honestly.
Yeah, and that's the power that these folks have. You know, and I love the fact that the vast majority of music and creative art stuff out there, you know, are powers for good. I don't think we would have... I think we'd still... I mean, there are elements of society today which are still in the dark ages, but I think things could be a lot worse without music. Let's just say that. Last thing about music then. So in terms of like being profound, is there any kind of particular song or thing that really hits you? Like, because I've got a couple of things that are like, that's my song kind of thing, you know, but.
There are a couple of bands where... So when I was a teenager, I used to drag my poor dad out to a lot of gigs in London. and there are some bands now that I can't listen to without thinking about him, about like those times. Because, I mean, he lives on the other side of the country to me now. And some of those bands are no longer together. But, you know, I can still listen to their music and it reminds me of that time and makes me feel kind of, I guess, like comforted or maybe a bit like I'm at home, that kind of thing. Yeah, it's pretty lovely.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So, a couple of shout outs for me. So I would say, dance ones quite a bit. So like, Heaven, that's not Alice DJ. That was a Better Off Alone. Oh God, I can't even remember the, but yeah, Better Off Alone anyway, was like clubbing in Greece. You know, that always brings that very strong memory. Anything by Wolf Alice or, Lord, always takes me back to when I was spending time in San Francisco, because that was part of my playlist for San Francisco when I was living out there. So yeah, it does take you back, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, music does it to us. It's like it is a sanity hook, isn't it? It really is an anchor. Wow. Okay. Well, this is weird because normally I'm like now wrapping up the podcast after Spill the Beans, but we got into music early. Excellent. Right. Okay, so let's come back now to, because you mentioned Exeter and the Met Office and all that kind of stuff. And let's have a little chat about what you're doing for the Royal Meteorological Society and the Youth and Early Careers Group. So we've, as I say, we've got this conference coming up, which is amazing. But the reason why you're doing this is because, I'll ask how you got to be their engagement fellow, because I imagine that you came into it through your PhD. So your PhD sets you in still being quite youth and early careers, so you qualify through that, but you also try and do as much public engagement. So how did you come about becoming their science engagement fellow? I mean, what was the process to that, and how are you enjoying it so far?
To be honest, so one of my PhD supervisors is in Bristol, and I actually go to their group meetings every week, like via Zoom. And the science engagement fellow for insurance used to be in that group, and she posted on the Slack they're looking to hire someone for the youth and early career role as well as the insurance role, and I thought, I don't know if I should really go for that. So initially I kind of ignored the job advert, and then over time I was like, actually, you know what, I'll apply and I'll see what happens. I applied, I got to interview, I joined the interview call, and the chief exec of the Met Society was one on my interview panel, and I was like, oh my gosh, you know.
Oh, is that Liz Bentley?
Yeah, I was terrified.
But she's lovely, though.
But she is lovely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the interview, what I had to do was actually come up with three activities or initiatives that the society could do to support youth in early careers. And I'm trying to remember now. I think one of them I came up with was like a hackathon. One of them was a mentoring scheme. And I really can't remember what the third one was. But they liked them. And I got hired, started, June 2023. Yeah. And I'll be finishing June 2024. So
yeah, it's a year-long thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us. So what is it consisting of at the moment? I mean, I know obviously, for example, in our meetings, in our youth and early careers meetings, you're the chair and things like that. But what other responsibilities has that brought for you?
Yeah. So I would say this youth and early career special interest group, you know, that was set up in 2022, I think. And the idea of that is to basically get the youth and early career perspective on society activities. And also that group can bring their own ideas and we can sort of take them to fruition. So one example is the media comms training videos, which you filmed some stuff for. And that was an idea that came out of that group. And those videos are going to be put up online for our members, hopefully imminently. That was something that, you know, youth and early careers wanted training on. They wanted to know how to communicate their science to the media. So the society were like, yeah, we can help provide a bit of that. God, amongst all the other things, I guess, going on, I think maybe some of the highlights of my last year or so have been helping the society relaunch their student ambassador program. Mm. So we took, I think we had under 10 student ambassadors. We now have over 30 across 20 different amazing. Universities. Yeah. It's, and you know what? They're amazing people as well, the student ambassadors. There are some who have gone really like above and beyond. It's very exciting actually to see their enthusiasm and to see kind of the next generation who are hopefully coming up very soon. And I guess the other thing that I maybe feel proudest of is my work on the diversity side with the society.
Yes.
So I've helped launch this Diverse Voices speaker series. We're in the process of properly launching this Early Careers of Colour Network, which is like an online community. And my kind of drive behind that was actually chatting with someone at the Early Career Conference last summer. They said it'd be great to have something like this. I took it to the society and they was so supportive, and you know, about 6 months plus later, it's gone live. Like it's actually happening, and it feels a bit surreal at times.
And I just wanted to thank you for being part of the process to spearhead that, and to really galvanize people to do that. And you know, it's something that I've spoken a lot about on this podcast. You know, both the, you know, the marginalized voice, and I know that term gets bandied about a lot, and there's risk of it being diluted, but you know, it really does stand to its definition. It's the voices that aren't heard, that have a, you know, disproportionate you know, minuscule voice compared to the people who do have the voice. I mean, you know, folks like yourself, like Aisha, you know, Kansas, and other people in that group have so much to offer in this community, have unique insights, have a brilliant way of looking at things that folks like, you know, like me can't grasp, you know, maybe because of the color of my skin or just simply because I'm a completely different background, and you know, and I have benefited from, you know, things like male privilege and white privilege and stuff like that, especially male privilege in the past, even though I'm not male. But you know, it's such an important thing. And I think also with the work with things like decolonizing geography, you know, and having promoted what you're doing in that group, and they're so enthusiastic about what that's going on, because this voice is really, really, really needed. And folks, when people say, oh, is this just woke or tokenism or panderism, I just want you to think of this, right? It's just such a simple thing that can help change your mind. The more people you have involved with their thinking, I mean, okay, you're going to have more discourse, you'll have more agreements and disagreements, all that kind of stuff. Fine, that's great. But say, for example, you only let males speak in the entire planet, which does happen in some societies, right? You're only getting 50% of the ideas. You'll only have further society by 50% max. You'll only come up with certain perspectives. And so therefore, you'll have many blind spots. So you'll have twice as many blind spots. And it's the same when you have with people of colour. If you don't involve people of colour, you've still got the same thing. You're not utilising such the wealth, the beauty, the experience that these people bring. And if you exclude those voices, the people who they represent don't benefit either or can't contribute themselves by proxy. So Regan, what you're doing there is absolutely amazing. So I really want you to plug this young people of colour for the Royal Met Society. So tell us a little bit more about this Diverse Things, the upcoming one, and let us know. Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes how people can sign up for it. But yeah, let us know a bit more about that, so because I really want people to engage with that.
Yeah, so the Diverse Voices series is open to anyone to come along to. These are online talks. They're about 45 minutes or so. The first half is invited speakers talking about their backgrounds or their journeys to where they are. And then the second half is Q&A. And it's, I would say the first half is probably going to be recorded, but the Q&A is not going to be. And the idea of that is to have completely open conversation. People shouldn't be afraid to ask questions that they might be on the internet forever or whatever. Yes. And so the first event that we did for this was myself and another PhD student, Asha Aslam at Leeds University, talking about what it's been like kind of in academia up to the point that we're at as people of colour. The next one, which is going to be 26th of March, so as we speak, it's next week. We've got Associate Professor Anita Gannison from Bristol, who has had a really interesting career. I believe she was at MIT. She's come over to the UK now. She sits on all kinds of really exciting CO2 related panels in terms of nice. The impacts of CO2 on climate change, so a bit terrifying. And then in June we'll have two people from the Met Office, Leila Gohar and Michael Lai, talking about what it's like to be there. I'm really excited for both of those. And then beyond that, the idea of calling it Diverse Voices was actually so we could widen out to more kinds of diversity over time. So we're really looking forward to having we're thinking of doing something for International Day of People with Disabilities. Hope I've remembered that right, which is in December. I would love to do something for LGBT History Month next February. But yeah, fingers crossed that it continues, that it becomes a bit self-perpetuating, that people put themselves forward to speak or suggest other people to speak. Like, we really want it to be community led, basically.
Yeah, and that's it, folks. And the thing is as well, it's we are battling through this residue of systemic barriers and glass ceilings, things like that. And there is still Regan and I and folks who do this kind of work, we understand that there is still skepticism amongst certain communities about these kind of things. It's like, you know, and so therefore folks don't put themselves forward because they still feel disempowered, disenfranchised, skeptical, you know, because of the historical residue, because they've never trusted the system, they never thought it worked for them, and why should I put myself out there because things aren't going to change. That is a completely valid thing for people to think. It's one of the reasons why, for example, I would love so much more diverse voices on this podcast, but I struggle to get them often because people just see me, Kit just wants me to tick a box. That's not their fault. That's not their fault. That's my fault. People of my culture, my background, I'm part of a colonial process that have been historically part of setting up the system that makes people feel disenfranchised. So what I will say is that it just needs a few of us to step outside our comfort zone, to engage with things like this. And the folks that are doing the stuff with you, Regan, already, those two folks in the Met Office and whatnot, excellent, are leading the way and showing we're going to take this power back and we're going to take this because we feel like we're valued. And if you're not of colour, folks, if you're not LGBT, if you're cisgender, if you're heterosexual, if you're white, you are welcome to be observers in this space. So when Regan says this is a public thing online, which is out there, and I realize that the one on the 26th of March is going to be finished by the time this podcast episode comes out, the recording is out there for you to still watch. Okay, we'll put the show link in the show notes and everything like that. Please, please step outside your comfort zone, sit in and listen, learn. And when that camera gets turned off, ask those questions that you feel you really wanted to ask but feel scared to ask. That's how society moves forward. So I can't say it enough, Regan, for thanks for the things that you and other folks have done to put yourselves out there. I know as a visible member of the LGBT community, it can be very emotionally demanding at times. And so I can't say thank you enough. So
no, it's, you know, it's funny, sometimes I definitely have those moments where I'm like, why am I the one that has to put my head above the parapet kind of thing? But some, you know, I recognize I have a lot of privilege. You know, I come from middle class background, you know, I did work in finance for a bit. I've seen what the world is like different from academia, so I know what's possible in terms of diversity.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, what, after I gave that first talk for Diverse Voices, I was nervous actually about what the reception might be like, because some of the members of the society, Royal Meteorological Society, they've said things like, you know, we don't have a diversity problem, EDI is woke. One of my favorite, I hope they don't mind me saying this, but one of, it's anonymous anyway, but someone said something like, you know, if people of color wanted to work in this field of weather and climate, then they would work here. And it's like, but then they're not, you know? And do you never stop
holding
to
my
ask
tongue.
Why? I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it was surprising to me, even though maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. And some of the people who I wish had come to that talk or had watched it back on YouTube didn't. And, you know, there are some people I work with who have maybe never worked with someone who wasn't like them before. And they don't realize sometimes that the language they use or the way that they behave it's not very welcoming sometimes.
Yeah.
And maybe if they watch something like this, it would, you know, they might not think, oh, this is about me, but they might become more aware of their own behavior or the effect that their words can have on other people. That's the kind of, that's what the change I would like to see, that people who don't think it's for them, just give it a chance.
And actually, when they immerse themselves in this system, they find out actually it's not, over time, if they embrace it and not take it as an attack, and that does take practice, granted, it's actually very liberating. And I've said this before. I've gone from being someone, I mean, when I was really at odds with my identity and I was struggling with self-esteem and stuff like that, I took everything personal, you know, and I thought everything was an attack. And when I got called out on things, I was very defensive. And it wasn't until I started to discover my own identity and realize that, you know, I'm actually part of these, you know, one of these groups who often gets othered, you know, and starting to embrace that and think about that, I actually have moved from being comfortable with being uncomfortable and being called out. You know, we had an EDI training locally a few weeks ago, which was amazing. And shout out to my friend Bex before her, who led that. You're an amazing human being, Bex. And at the end, someone pulled me aside and called me out for something I said. And, you know, I'm like, thank you for doing that. I thought about it. I said, yeah, I kind of realized that didn't come across how I wanted, but that's no excuse. I should think about what I say before I say it. So, you know, and you learn, and it makes you a better person. And then you suddenly another color gets added to your palette of the experience of the life. So, folks, do it. And a talk I did a few weeks ago in Manchester, the demographic was pretty white and pretty old. And it was an uncomfortable space for me to be in because I was relatively young and I was definitely felt out of place in that. But I got there and a lot of people there were wonderful and were receptive and asked some very good questions. And that's it. And you go away and you think about it. As long as you're respectful and you respect the space, do it. Yeah. So well done. So Regan, we'll put all that stuff in the chat. So anything, all the recordings and stuff like that, where people can access those, that's brilliant. Okay. Your PhD. Oh. Yes. Folks, if you want to switch off for the next like 500 hours, I don't know. It's like, if you want to switch off for the next, no, don't switch off because this is absolutely fascinating. Right. Now, I am aware of what things like the stratospheric pathway and stuff like that is and the kind of the potential impacts it has around for global climate and global weather systems. However, for folks who are not sure about what this thing is, can you please start, first of all, start by explaining what we, do we mean by the stratospheric pathway?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to put my cup of tea down.
Yeah, oh, it's required. Yep.
Crazy hand gestures. okay, so maybe to start from basics, in case people aren't aware, we live in a layer of the atmosphere called the troposphere. So this is where we experience weather and climate. It's got all these, it's got lots of moisture in it, it's got some clouds in it. And it's almost like, it's kind of like a blanket over the surface of the planet. That's where we live. The layer of the atmosphere above that is called the stratosphere. And you, if you've ever been on a long haul flight, it's possible that you've actually ascended to such an altitude that you might be sort of grazing the bottom of the stratosphere. It's kind of, it's tens of kilometers above our heads. And it's almost a completely different world up there. It's very dry. There's definitely, I mean, there are sometimes clouds in the very lower levels, especially near the poles, but it's mostly, it's pretty weather free. And it's also quite hot in the stratosphere. And the reason for that is because that's where the ozone layer sits. I think a lot of people will have heard of the ozone layer. And ozone kind of works by absorbing a lot of incoming sunlight. So it protects us a lot from some of those damaging rays from the sun, and also prevents us from getting too hot down on the surface. Now, one of the parts of the stratosphere that I'm most interested in is the stratospheric polar vortex, which I think sounds sick every time I see it. But it's basically this kind of band of really strong winds encircling the pole in the wintertime. So it exists over the South Pole and the North Pole in their respective winters. Now, in the South Pole, it's actually quite strong and steady as a kind of band of winds, just because there are fewer continents over the South Pole, and that has implications for kind of wave propagation in the atmosphere and how much that can disrupt the vortex up in the stratosphere. And then over the North Pole, which is what I kind of focus on, the polar vortex, it sometimes breaks down in the wintertime, and that happens roughly every other year. And we call this a sudden stratospheric warming. And that's basically because the polar vortex, which usually encloses this kind of really cold body of air over the Arctic, it suddenly warms up within tens of degrees over a period of days. And that causes the winds to just completely, it's like they just forget what they're doing. They just completely disrupt. In some cases, the polar vortex actually reverses direction, and you can end up with a vortex that is displaced, or in really extreme cases, it can split into two little polar vortices. You could probably imagine that something like a polar vortex splitting into two, I mean, it sounds dramatic, and it is quite dramatic, even for us on the surface, which is, you know, tens of kilometres away from where this is happening. And so for those of us in the UK, you might remember in 2018, we had this beast from the east.
East from the east. Yeah,
infamous. Now, one of the reasons why they think that was such a huge storm, or why it was such a long-lasting cold spell, we had a lot of snow in the UK and in Northern Europe, is because there was a storm system near the surface, but also there was a sudden stratospheric warming beforehand. And it was kind of excuse the pun, it was a perfect storm of different elements of the climate coming together. Yep. And just causing this, it was mayhem. I remember I was sent home. They were like, it's dangerous for you to be here in case you get stranded. And so that's the kind of stratospheric pathway I'm talking about. I'm talking about how the surface can affect the stratosphere, which is, you know, feels like a million miles away, but it's, you know, above our head somewhere. And then the stratosphere having its own effect on the surface, a kind of like a bit of a loop of connection within the atmosphere. I hope that made sense.
That's brilliant. Well, as soon as you said beast from the east, then you know, I think a lot of people can identify that. Yeah, so you know, there was, I think folks like the Met Office and, you know, BBC Weather, they did their absolute best to try and link all this to what happens in the stratosphere. And, you know, it's one way to think about it, folks, as well. If you're sitting in the bath and you're like, oh, the bath's getting a bit cold and I'm gonna turn the tap on, right, for a bit, you might feel for a little bit that kind of like away from like where the tap's coming, where the water's coming in, you put your hand in and like the surface, near the surface, is actually quite warm and hot as the hot water's coming in. And then if you plunge your hand a little bit further down, it still feels a bit cooler. So you've got that stratification, that temperature gradient. Now I want you to imagine if you could drop a bit, and you can do this experiment actually in science, stuff like that. You put a drop of like food coloring or something like that in some water, which can like, you can see, and there are, you can see videos of this on YouTube actually, where you can see like the different layers of water, of temperature water like that. But what you'll notice is that as, say, the top layer is moving around, it will drag everything underneath it, right? So it's, you know, it's just like friction. You know, if you rub your hand over a surface now, you can feel that friction. You know, you're actually impacting those molecules on that surface, right? So you're dragging. And that is what the things in the stratosphere does to the things in the troposphere, which is where we are. You know, it's they're not like a complete disconnect barrier, and there's like a barrier and there's no interaction at all. You know, things that happen in the stratosphere have an impact on things that happen in the troposphere and vice versa. So so it's not like a neat little boundary, which we call the tropopause. It's like there's sort of intermittent mixing. It's where, you know, you get turbulent layers and things like that. And you get the, just Riggs already said, you've got things like vortices and the jet streams and things like that. So, yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. And, of course, we're really interested about this because, of course, we feel that climate change is something which is going to be impacting these systems. And people say, oh, yeah, climate change, Kit. Beast from the east, that's not climate change. How can we drop to these very cold temperatures and have blizzards? That's not global warming, is it? And then like, this is why we do what we do, Regan, isn't it? Is this is why we need science communication, is because switching of modes, collapses, fragmentation of the polar vortex, whatever it is, can be a symptom of climate change. And so you can have severe winter storms and blizzards because of a warming planet. How I mean, I know how I would try and describe why that's the case. This is a tricky one. This is one of the hardest ones we have to try and communicate. But how would you try and describe that to someone, like, yeah, actually a warming planet could cause very severe cold snaps in our latitude in where like the UK is?
So I could talk about it from the perspective of some of the PhD research I've done to date has been about specifically how Arctic climate change can affect the kind of mid-latitudes that we're sat at in the UK or Northern Europe, North America and Eurasia. So the Arctic is actually warming, they think, about four times faster than the rest of the planet. And that's for a variety of reasons. Like, there are some very complex physics going on up there. Also, it's to do with, you know, if you've got ice, which is very reflective, you're bouncing a lot of the sunlight back out from the surface of the Earth. Once you warm the planet and some of that ice is melting, you're actually exposing the ocean beneath it, which is darker. And that ocean absorbs the heat instead of reflecting it out. And when the winter comes around, it kind of acts like a bit of a radiator. It lets all that heat out again. Actually, you end up melting even more ice, and therefore you're exposing more ocean. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle in that sense. I would say that it's quite a contentious topic within research, what the effect of Arctic sea ice loss is going to have on the mid-latitudes. You know, there are some theories that say if you're heating the Arctic more than the tropics, for example, so near the equator, you actually get this weakening of the temperature gradient between the equator and the pole. So the difference in temperatures is smaller, basically. And this can have an effect on winds, particularly the jet stream. So if you've got a weaker temperature gradient, you get weaker winds. There is suggested theory that your jet stream becomes weaker and as a result could become, to use a technical term, wigglier or wavier. If you get a wavier jet stream, you can kind of think of the jet stream as carrying weather systems along with it. If it's weaker and it's got these kind of bigger loops in it, these weather systems could potentially hang around for longer over our heads. So if you've got a cold or a storm weather system, it could stick around for longer under climate change than it might have done without it. So when we talk about having really cold temperatures, you know, cold for a couple of days is, it's not particularly enjoyable, but cold for like a week or longer, I mean, that's going to have implications for our health and for our infrastructure. You know, it could do a lot of damage. And it's the same the other way around with yeah. extreme heat as well. Like, yeah, I mean, we've already seen really high temperatures in the UK. We've exceeded 40 degrees. You know, it's some people might never have thought that would happen in the UK. But the problem is, you know, that could happen. It could be a one-off. Or if these weather systems are more persistent, it could last for even longer. And yeah, I mean, I don't really want to think about what that's going to mean for a lot of the population.
Yeah.
It's pretty scary, really. But
yeah, it's and you're right to disclaim that, the, you know, the fact that there's still a lot of scientific research going on this. Because it's such, the thing is, and this doesn't mean that scientists don't know what's going on, or they can't you know, give probability. And that's the thing you've got to remember, folks, when it comes to climate projections and climate change, that's why scientists talk in uncertainty and improbability. Uncertainty does not mean they don't know. What it means is that they are honest with what still needs to be figured out. So uncertainty is the case in all science, right? It's in all science. It doesn't matter if you're doing a you do that old classic primary school thing, you know, we're growing cress on your windowsill, right? The fact that you don't know whether those seeds are going to germinate tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon, or tomorrow night, that's uncertainty. That's scientific uncertainty. It's the window of when things can happen, right? Mm-hmm. So even growing cress on your windowsill has uncertainty. It's the same principle when it comes to this. So there is a level of uncertainty using our data about exactly what the warming in the Arctic and this lowering of the temperature gradient is going to do to these weather systems. But within that realm of uncertainty, you have probabilities, and there is a good significant probability that this is what's going to happen, but we still need more research. And I like to describe it as opening a fridge or freezer door. So where the jet stream is where you open the fridge or freezer door, right? Or on the other side of the jet stream, it's where you suddenly blast the heater on. So if you've got this wavy line, when it waves up and the UK is underneath that up, it's almost like you're sticking a heater there, right? And you're blowing heat into the UK. If the wavy bit's coming down and the UK is above that wavy bit, it's almost as though you're opening the fridge door and all of a sudden that air goes down from the Arctic, right? So those things, the science suggests that's what can happen more frequently, is we'll have more of these heat wave ridges, blocking ridges, which can cause 40 plus degree temperatures, which will be incredibly, I can't stand anything above 25 Regan, to be honest. But then on the other scale, you could have that opposite snap effect where you've got, you know, Arctic conditions, you know, coming in sustained from the north. So it's complex, and it is our job to try and communicate that, you know, as clear as we could. But and I've said this before. I said this to Aisha actually last episode, Regan. There is a morbid fascination in this stuff. Like, we hate that this is happening as humans. It's concerning, and this is why we do what we do, because we want to get action, we want hope and stuff like that. But as a scientist, there is a morbid fascination about this kind of thing. It's to turn the planet into a whole big experiment is morbidly scientifically fascinating. I mean, I'll ask you the same question I ask Aisha. How do you square that with your PhD? Like, on one hand, it's like, this is quite depressing. On the other hand, you're like, this is bloody amazingly fascinating. How do you square that circle?
That is a great question. You know, a lot of people who I meet sort of when I'm doing outreach, or I'm in a choir, which is full of normal people, like not academics, and they say, oh, what do you do? And you tell them you're doing a PhD in climate change, climate science, whatever. And they say, oh my gosh, you must be really depressed all the time. And it's like, yeah, you know what? Sometimes you read some papers and you're like, oh gosh, this is actually pretty grim. I think there are quite a few scientists who I know or have met who have this element of detachment from what they're doing. I personally find that quite difficult to do because I'm a human being who lives on this planet. And it's, you know, I don't remember the last time we had a white Christmas, but I remember having snowy winters and suddenly they're not happening anymore. And I'm like, that's pretty weird. To me, I'm like, I can see climate change happening. And to have detachment from that in the work that I do, I don't think I could do it personally. However, if you're going to be kind of sad or you're going to feel helpless all the time, then you're just not going to do anything about it. You're not going to make progress in your work because you're going to feel like it's all a bit too much. You're not going to go out and do outreach because you're going to think, what's the point? There is a point, you know, educating the general public who, like me, they see, you know, winters have changed, but they might not know why. They might not know what they can do about it, you know, they just have a lot of questions that scientists can answer for them, but they're just not in contact with them to ask those questions directly. And I think maybe that's a bit extreme to say, but I think it's a form of activism to do science outreach. I also think it's our responsibility as scientists to tell people what's going on. And what I wish was different about academia is that we had more training in communicating our science to non-experts. Not just because of talking to the public, but when you talk to policymakers, they're not going to be an expert, are they? You know, you have to figure out a way to not overwhelm people with jargon or too much information.
You put that really, that's my sentiments exactly. You've put that exactly right. And I elaborate a little bit more with Aisha as well, so folks can listen back to that one if they wish. Right, should we go on to something a little bit more fun? Not that our work is fun as well. You know, we love it, and Regan is really, really, you know, they've really, really been very clear about how I feel about it and why we still do these kind of things and why we've still got hope and why we've still got hope. But let's move on to barking up the wrong tree, which is something I haven't done for a while. So let's do this. Brilliant. So I'm going to tell Regan two stories, and Regan's going to try and guess which one's the fake one and which one's the real one, right? So because of our connection with the youth and early careers SIG, special interest group for the Royal Met Society, I thought I'd go for something about young scientists, right? So one of these stories is real and one of these stories is fake. So let me just get my two stories up, because otherwise I don't want to misrepresent either of them. Okay, so the first one was dated 2015. And it is about a 14-year-old Emily Chen. And Emily Chen, so I'll just read out part of this site. It's the summary of the article at the top here. In a remarkable turn of events, 14-year-old Emily Chen, driven by a deep concern for the environment, has devised a groundbreaking solution to the worldwide scourge of plastic pollution. Hailing from a small town in California, Emily's journey began with a passionate interest in environmental issues from a school eco club, but also based on personal experiences of seeing litter on Californian beaches. Experimenting at home and drawing upon resources from her inspirational teacher from the Eco Club, Emily immersed herself in the study of chemistry and material sciences, and she approached the problem of plastic pollution with fresh eyes and guided by a youthful creativity and innovative thinking. Through countless trials and errors, her determination has led her to a biodegradable alternative to traditional plastic polymers. Her invention, which mimics the durability of conventional plastics while decomposing harms in natural environments, promises to revolutionize waste management and practice and reduce the environmental impact of plastic pollution. So it goes on some more about how she's been put forward for the environmental program's Young Champions of the Earth Award, all that kind of stuff. So that's the first one, okay? That's the first one, Emily Chen and plastic. Here's the second one. So another 14-year-old. Okay, 14-year-old who, yeah, I know, makes you feel inadequate. Yeah, exactly. 14-year-old who invented soap to treat skin cancer, named as America's top young scientist, right? So Heman Bekele, a ninth grader from Virginia, so that's year eight in our speak, folks, was named America's young top scientist after he invented a 50 cent, so about 35 pence, bar of soap that could treat skin cancer. So he was won the prestigious award from 3N and Discovery Education, considered one of the country's top middle school science competitors. He said, "I believe that young minds can make a positive impact on the world," after his submission of the award. "I've always been interested in biology and technology, and this gave me the perfect platform to showcase my ideas." So He spent the past 4 months competing against 9 other finalists to be America's top scientists. In addition to the prestigious title, young scientists who win the award also get a $25,000 cash prize. Ooh. And a ninth grader from San Jose, California, won second place for developing a cost-effective patch that allows for self-automated medication delivery without pills or needles. Right. So there we go. So Eva, the 14-year-old who invented a soap that could treat skin cancer, or the 14-year-old who, via a passionate teacher at an eco club, studied up on chemistry and found a way to come up with biodegradable plastic alternatives. Which one do you think, Regan?
Oh my gosh, they both sound like amazing 14-year-olds. Gosh, when I was 14, I was busy reading like Kerrang magazine.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a tough one. I would be intrigued to know more details about this bar of soap that can fight, or was it fight or prevent skin cancer?
I think it says treat skin cancer. Treat. Yeah, let me just pull up the article, whether it is an article I wrote or an article that is real. Let me just pull it up. Treat skin cancer. So a 14-year-old who invented a soap that treats skin cancer.
My gosh. I mean, they both sound amazing. I think I'm going to say that Emily Chen is real.
Okay, Emily Chen is real and Hemen Bekele is, well, Regan.
Oh no.
I completely made up the Emily Chen story.
Oh, there, no.
I know there is a story out there about a young person come up with biodegradable alternative for plastic, but it hasn't got to the stage where it's such like world beating. And if it was 2015 or whatever it is, it would have been hot news by now, and we would have been well on the way. The story about Hemen Bekele is true.
Gosh.
And I'm looking at and I'll put a link in the description, folks. There's a picture of him right here with his mentor, Deborah Isabel, being presented with the award in St. Paul, Minnesota. Huh, that's where my wife is from. Last year, October 2023, who is a project, and Deborah Isabel is a project engineering specialist at 3M. So yeah,
wow.
And he's looking very proud, bless him, with his gold medal around his neck and his award.
Well,
so there you go, folks. Yeah. So if you're a young person, listen to this, boom, don't give up, you know, and don't forget, an early episode we had was with Simon and Sam Fox, who co-founded the Youth STEM Award. So if you haven't listened to that episode, folks, and you're a teacher or you're a parent or carer of a young person, go and listen to that episode with Sam and Simon, and find out about the Youth STEM Award, okay? Because you never know. You could be the next man. Who knows? Right. Okay, Regan, let's finish this wacky chat off now with We Are All Geographers. So this is where we string all of our guests together using a single word or phrase, and they get to talk about it for 30 seconds, link it to geography if they can, or their work if they can. We'll see how we get on. So our colleague Aisha was the one who came up with your word, Regan. So you can, if you feel hard done by this one, you can go and
strongly worded
Aisha. Right. But anyway, in all fairness, you know what? I think this one, well, it's easy because I think it's something that you can relate to very easily, but maybe hard because perhaps you can say so much about this word. So the word that Aisha's come up with for you to talk about for 30 seconds is culture. Culture. So now, because of your love of music, your love of, you know, what you've been talking about as well, the fact that, you know, diverse voice, you could go for more than 30 seconds on culture, but you've only got 30 seconds. I've got a little timer I can play for you so you can hear when the buzzer goes. So when you're ready, Regan, are you ready to talk about the word culture for 30 seconds?
I'm ready.
Right. Okay, here comes a timer. Off you go.
I think I want to talk about academic culture as much as I love arts and culture. You know, there's sometimes when you come into academia from somewhere else, you feel overwhelmed. And there's a lot of talk about academic culture and you feel like you have to fit in. Sometimes being respected is actually a matter of feeling like other people respect you. It's about how you feel on the inside. If you're different, it's okay. If you think people treat you differently because you're different, that's really not your problem.
What a lovely message. Oh,
okay?
No. I think that must be the first We Are All Geographers that was also a pep talk.
You can do this.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love all the different approaches to that 30 seconds. You know, some people would go off on a, like one previous guest, Andrew, he basically just went off on a rant, like on HDMI. It was brilliant, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was brilliant. So some people use it to get something off, skin off their teeth. Some people, you know. So yeah, brilliant. Excellent. Right. For our next guest then, Regan, what word would you like to give to them?
It can be any word.
Any words? Yeah.
I think I will go with flowers.
Oh, nice. We'll go with flowers, folks. Yeah, I was going to say any word, as long as it's family friendly. We are a family friendly.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, so Regan, folks, they are giving our next guest the word flowers. So I'll make sure I put that down so I don't forget. Right. Finally then, Regan, how can people, so again, we'll put in the show notes stuff and Regan, folks, will double check that I get the right links in the show notes and stuff when we get ready for to release the podcast. But regards to getting in contact with yourself, I mean, do you have any social media accounts or how can people get hold of you via MetSoc, for example? What would you like to let us know about how people can connect with you?
Yeah, so for the Meteorological Society stuff, I will be in the role until the start of June 2024. You can check out the Royal Met Soc website. You can look at the Youth and Early Career Special Interest Group by putting it into the search bar. Or you can email me. I'm at fellowship@rmets.org. I don't really have social media. Sorry about that.
All the better for it. No, all the better for it.
I like to remain anonymous. I think I have a university webpage, though. If you type my name into Google, you can find my uni webpage, which has
probably find
email
it.
Address on it. So if you have questions about my science, then you can email me, I
yes.
suppose. A bit old school, awesome. But yeah, there you go, that's me.
It's lovely. Email is old school. I know. Oh, mate, ages me, Regan, I tell you that. Yeah, and would you like to give any, I mean, we've given a shout out, obviously, to Aisha and anyone else you want to give a shout out to?
Honestly, everybody that's on this Youth and Early Career Special Interest Group, the inputs that they have, the insights that they have, it's been really valuable for me personally, but also I think the society have come a long way in terms of their engagement with that kind of demographic. So it's been great to see. Yeah, thank you to all of you and all of them.
Yeah, no, thank you, folks. Yeah, because, you know, any institution with the word rural in it, have got a lot of work to do. Yeah. You know, they're based on a colonial construct, but we know that the Royal Met Soc are doing the best they can. You know, Royal Geographical Society are making good strides, you know, with Shanique and Roe and things like that, who we've also had on the podcast. So, yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And, folks, I know I'm not youthful anymore, but I'm still clinging on to the definition of what means for early careers, because in terms of having a paid job as a science communicator, I am technically early career, so I'm just hanging on by the skin of my teeth. Whereas I'm talking to people like Aisha and Regan are like, I don't know, half my age or something. I don't know, but you know, it's always wonderful. And I always get inspired by young people. It doesn't matter if they're high school level, if they're you know, masters, undergrads, always inspiring, Regan. And speaking to folks like you, it just circling back to what we said a bit earlier about hope in all of the and all of what's going on, you know, if knowing that folks like you are out there and doing what you're doing, it keeps me going in what I'm doing. So I just want to say personally thank you for what you and other folks are doing.
Well, thank you for giving people like me and others a platform. It's amazing. Thank you.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you very much for joining me, Regan.
Of course. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.